Welcome to the Book Show, a celebration of reading and writers. I'm Joe Donahue. In Rachel Kushner's new novel, Creation Lake, Sadie Smith, a 34-year-old American undercover agent of ruthless tactics, bold opinions, and clean beauty, is sent by her mysterious but powerful employers to a remote corner of France. Her mission to infiltrate a commune of radical eco-activists led by the charismatic Bruno Lacombe. Sadie casts her cynical eye over the region of ancient farms and sleepy villages, and at first finds Bruno's idealism laughable. He lives in a Neanderthal cave and believes the path to enlightenment is a return to primitivism. But just as Sadie is certain she's the seductress and puppet master of those she surveils, Bruno is seducing her with his own ingenious counter histories, his artful laments, his own tragic story. Rachel Kushner is the author of the Booker Prize nominated The Mars Room. Creation Lake has already been long listed for the 2024 Booker Prize, and it is a great pleasure to welcome Rachel Kushner to this week's book show. Thank you so much for being with us. What a delight to have you on the program.
Thank you, Joe. It's a pleasure to be here.
First of all, congratulations on the Booker long list. That's very cool. That happened before the book even was released. That's very cool. That's very nice.
It is very cool. Every writer has their own relationship to the public and reactions to their books. It's an honor to be read, regardless of these kinds of measures of critical success. And one never wants to expect anything at all. When I'm writing, I feel like I am inhabiting a sustained dream / fantasy that's incredibly fun for me. This book in particular, I can honestly say was the most fun I've ever had doing anything. I mean, the writing of it. I wasn't thinking as I was writing it, like, oh, I hope this is, a book that other people like as much as I do. It just really didn't factor into things. And then finding out I was on the long list for the Booker, I kind of thought in a measured way, well, that's pretty cool, but I have no control over that. That's the outside world. But then I have to say, I did start to enjoy the news when I began hearing from friends and family, and especially folks who don't really pay attention to the literary world, to the publishing world, just simply read the newspaper. And I thought, well, that is sort of neat, because they were really proud, like, oh, you're in the paper. But again, I mean, the main point for me is just how much fun I had writing this book. So my attachment to it's quite personal.
So let's talk about that for a moment, because I've been doing a show with authors for a very long time, and you don't often hear authors talk about the process of writing being fun. In fact, okay, Most just say it's hard and miserable. So I'm rather delighted that this was a fun process for you.
Look, I don't want to call out other people, but maybe I will say, I've said this before, it's not like someone's putting a gun to your head and saying, right, you must write a novel. So in a way, I do wonder why do it if it's misery from beginning to end. I think for most people, it probably really isn't that, although I can't speak for them. It's a process. It's strange, because making art is really about profound doubt and asking questions and never judging. But it also requires a hearty confidence that you're going to be able to pull something off, because it doesn't seem that way to me at the beginning. There's not just the kind of useful philosophical doubt. There's also a doubt in self-confidence, like, this isn't really working. This doesn't seem to sparkle with the magic, the champagne on the page that I hope to produce. And then finally, one day, it starts to happen. So it's only through writing other books that I kind of know at some point it's probably going to happen. And I just need to put in the time and think and hope and be prepared for when it does. And with this book, it was like I somehow wrangled down this voice of this woman who speaks in the first person. She's the narrator. First line of the novel about Neanderthals being prone to depression as well as addiction, and of those in particular, smoking. That was the first line that I ended up writing, and it was her voice, but also reading secretly the emails of Bruno Lacombe, who is the kind of shadowy mentor to these people she's surveilling. It just all came together for me right there, and it was extremely fun. It felt like I'd created a parallel world that to me was as real and with as much dimension and detail as this world. And it almost came to seem that I preferred that world over the course of the very intense 14 months when I was actually writing the book after, years of thinking about it.
What was it about that world that you found to be of a relief from the one we're in?
The more I put into it, the more I got out of it. It just started to feel like I could really see these worlds. I could see this woman who, at first, defines herself, if a bit brittlely, for the reader, as somebody who is very confident in her ability to dissimulate and to manipulate other people. And to read into them weaknesses that they don't know are so obvious and exposed. Like they don't realize how sort of nakedly they stand before her. And she sort of gets off on seeing people that way. And it's a set of characteristics that I don't at all myself possess. I'm always looking to other people, like, what do they think? What do they know? Other people know so much, and I don't have privy to their thoughts. But Sadie's very overconfident. And over the course of the book, it was a question of what is going to happen? Will she start to crack in her facade? And that drew me along. And also at the same time, I was using a real cynic, in the form of her voice to report on, describe, observe a world that I personally am much more of a believer in. I'm predisposed to feel great sympathy for someone like Bruno, who is an elder, a kind of product of the generation of 1968 in France, who thought that maybe there would be a working class revolution that would reform the world, that would end the exploitation of the worker and bring about a kind of new and utopian equality among people. This did not happen in any of the European countries where, there were revolts and movements on the left. And Bruno has come to believe that it's never going to happen, that capitalism is absolutely here to stay. But he comes up with his own theory about how to, as he calls it, leave this world while remaining within it, to transform consciousness instead of try to hope for something that's never coming. And she looks at this, with a gimlet eye, whereas I would have much more sympathy for him. So it was that tension there between the two of them, and also being able to always come back to Bruno, because to me, his yearnings and his sense of a kind of loneliness, like modern man has been cut off from a long lineage in prehistory before the world of the written down. And he wonders, like, what took place there? What transpired? Were there messages that they might have left for us so that we could have knowledge about how to live our lives, how to proceed, what future lies in wait? And that was just really fun for me to return to him and see what else he was going to share, both about his own life and his travails and his thoughts on the human situation.
Rachel Kushner is the author of Creation Lake. The book is out from Scribner. Let me ask you about confidence, because the confidence that Sadie has, does it increase your confidence if you're writing about a very confident character?
I mean, there are different valences of this term confidence. And when I
Yes.
refer to her confidence, I kind of mean her arrogance, her sense that she's always the one who is thinking three steps ahead of everyone else in the room. And I never have that kind of confidence, and nor do I think it would prove to be empowering as a writer. Because you always want to be second guessing and giving other people the benefit of the doubt and thinking that that there's more to them than might seem to the eye. I don't, as a reader, I don't like to read a book in which the characters are rendered, portrayed by the author in a way that makes them less clever than the author. You know, like, oh, look at these pathetic people. It's like, no, you know, people are so much more than the sum of their visible parts. But
Right.
there was a kind of confidence for me in writing her that was less about her confidence and more about this form that I was playing with, which is the spy novel, you know, the roman noir. I'm not a genre writer, but I definitely studied that genre prior to writing this book, given that I was going to have an agent provocateur, you know, a secret agent who used to work for the feds in the US and then is in France working for these kind of like shadowy private interests. I wanted to be able to kind of do my version of the noir. And when you have a narrator who thinks that she's manipulating everybody else, she has plans, she's been assigned to this case to surveil these people, to put the communards on a collision course with the French police, the French state. When you have a narrator like that, it gives a different velocity to the plot. Because she's the one in control, rather than like normal life, somebody who's dropped into a world where there's a lot of chance. Sometimes writers rely on this little conceit called coincidence. It's usually rather cheap. All of us have done it, but the world is so vast and unknowable, and there's a lot of randomness. And usually writers are wrangling with that. But when you have a narrator who thinks they have the world all sewn up, it's quite a different form of confidence in terms of what I decide to have her do, because she's not gauging and looking and stepping back and hedging. She's putting guns in people's hands and putting plans in their heads.
I want to explore the research that you did into the genre itself, because you're certainly going to a very defined and very a genre with very rich history. You're also creating a whole new genre. You're creating something that really has never been done before in a really cool way. Once you have the details of that world, I mean, you have to know that world of where you're going to go, of what the rules are, for want of a better term, as you continue the writing process.
There are very specific sets of rules for this kind of genre, which is in large part why I wouldn't claim that my novel has, you know, has earned a position within the genre, and nor was that really my intent. A good friend of mine who knows me and my work very well, when she read a draft of the novel, she said, "Well, I feel like the narrator of this novel is in a noir novel. She's in a genre novel." But the novel itself is a novel by you, a Rachel Kushner novel. I don't know exactly what that means, but it felt right. Like she, in a way, is given some of the kind of classical attributes, usually like a more of maybe like a male character who's a spy, who's a little bit sardonic, you know, and wary of other people. But the allowance in the book for these more sort of philosophical musings of Bruno and a set of questions that come to the fore, not just for him, but for the reader, maybe, or at least for me as the writer, and I don't want to give things away, but maybe for Sadie too, are a little more, they're kind of outside the field of the genre novel. They're much more philosophical, I guess. And I don't know that the genre can really contain those questions. And they don't also, you know, the spy novel is not usually so much a character study and more of a specific narrative form that can be replaced with different details, you know, and present a new iteration. So yeah, I didn't, I would say that I studied less the rules of the genre and more a certain mood. And my own book, I would say, is kind of a homage in its way of
Right.
a very particular crime writer, this French guy named Jean-Patrick Manchette, who died in, I think, 1995, but in the 70s, he wrote like 10 novels in 10 years, and they are extremely funny. And, you know, they all take place in France. So it was like fun for me to see his relationship. He was also very much on the left politically, and just to see his relationship to French politics, there's like a strong streak of nihilism in those books that I found somewhat generative. And so my own book, in its way, is a kind of Valentine to Manchette. But Manchette knows so much about the genre. It's like he's almost like the Quentin Tarantino of the French crime novel, the way that Tarantino is to the pulp film. Like when you do your shoot 'em up scene, you've seen every single scene like that under the sun that's ever been made by any director, right? And you know like what angle the camera was coming from as it moved into the room and blah, blah, blah. And Manchette is like that for the bank heist, for the kidnapping, etc. And I could never reproduce that, but nor did I want to try. And yet I take my inspirations where I want to and can.
It's also fascinating to me. There's a couple of time, and you can correct me on the exact word usage here, which is where a character will make a statement, a declarative sentence, and you will say, "Said no one ever." It's sort of it's a running joke, and it's great because it again shows, oh, all right, this is what we think. And this is what really is going on here in this world we're reading about.
Yeah, I think some of her statements are like, I didn't say. And so they're the blunt assertion that Sadie would make, Sadie, so-called, that's what she tells the people she's surveilling and the reader what her name is. We don't actually know her real name, and all of her backstory that she provides in the book is only scenarios of previous dissimulations in which she engaged. So when she tells a backstory about some other experience of hers, it's when she was surveilling a group of bikers, in the American Northwest, or when she was entrapping a young anarchist whom she'd convinced to ratchet up his program to include the sabotage of property. If she were to speak bluntly to these people, which she never would, unless it served her some purpose professionally, there are certain things that she would say that she doesn't. And one of the freeing and fun aspects of writing her is that she has this release valve, which is the reader. And so she can turn to the reader and say something that she won't say in the room. Like she's pretending to be the lover of this poor, like kind of bourgeois, a little bit gullible guy, Lucien. He goes to buy one of those like plug-in mosquito repellent things they have in Europe. There's like a little case of liquid over the plug, and it, I guess, diffuses into the room. But come on, I mean, do those really work? He goes to buy one, and he's being ravaged by mosquitoes. And as she coolly and kind of cruelly comments to the reader, mosquitoes don't bother me. And he goes to buy the thing, and she says, those don't work, comma, I didn't say. So it's like she can just turn to the reader whenever she wants to and say what she wouldn't say to those with whom she's keeping a very, like a very tight access to who she really is.
It's a tight access. It's also a relationship then that is bonded with the reader that is different than many bonds that I've had in reading a novel, with the narrator.
Because I'm blessed with friendships with people who've been reading my work for a long time. I'm sometimes keen to hear what certain people have to say. And a friend of mine, actually, he's from Wisconsin, the filmmaker James Benning, he's from Milwaukee, and went to school in Madison. He at first he really didn't like Sadie. And I think that, I could imagine maybe particularly men having this reaction to her because there's something unbridled about her and severe. There's a kind of vulgarity to her sense of humor. I mean, that I'll confess is not so different from my own sense of humor, for which she was, a pretty useful or satisfying outlet. But I was interested to hear him say that. And another much younger guy, James is in his 80s, a younger guy said the same thing, like, whoa, she's really harsh. And then James reread the book. And I can't remember exactly what he said, but it was just interesting to hear him. It's not that he softened on her, but he was much more attuned to the way that she changes over the course of the novel. And he was much more interested in the challenge, which was the challenge I was interested in, which was having a pretty unsympathetic narrator trample on a world to which I personally am rather attached. So it forced me constantly into these reversals where I'm looking at things from 180 degrees to how I would normally view them.
Just the decision to have it take place in France, was that always something that you wanted to do? This is an American in France.
Yes, I always did. I had long had the idea of writing a novel whose situation or setup would be a group of French anarchists from Paris, like and other cities, who decamp to this remote rural area in southwestern France and set up a communal structure, and are set on a kind of collision course with the French state. Like that was something that I'd been working on. It also just so happens to be the case that I'd go to southwestern France every summer. This is the first summer that's an exception to that. I've been doing that for the last 15 years. And my son, Remy, the last 2 summers has worked at a camp in France. He's bilingual. He's a lucky kid because he went to French school. And the last 2 summers in camp, last 2 summers in France, excuse me, he worked at a camp as a spelunking guide. This part of France that we go to is totally subtended by this vast network of caves. And Lascaux is near there, and some other caves that, I mean, Lascaux is not public. They have this, simulacrum that you can visit. I've never done it. There are other caves that you can actually go in and see 30,000-year-old drawings. The caves that Remy goes into are not those. They're usually on either private or public property. You either lift a manhole cover with just some elbow grease, or you borrow a key from a farmer, and you go into these places where sometimes you have to shimmy through a crevice so narrow, he says, that you can't even turn your head. And that's like an hour of shimmying through a space like that. And he goes into caves that are filled with water up to the neck. And he's been doing that since he was like 7 years old. And so I had access through him to this world of the underground caves. And I had my own observations of the sort of social world of the farmers and a sense of history and peasant revolts that you feel in this part of France. I had a sense of the geography of what they grow, of what the traditions are, and also of the rural outmigration, the appearance of supermarkets that you have to drive to that are an hour away, and the sense of incredible difficulty for farmers to make a living in France currently.
The novel is set 10, 11 years in the past, and it is, I assume, consciously. And I'm curious as to what that allows you.
Yeah, that's such a good question. And I wish I had a perfect answer to it because the first part of my answer is I don't know. But you are absolutely right. The novel is kind of coyly set in 2013. She never states the year, but there's for me a significant clue, which is that the song of the summer in France in 2013 was Get Lucky by Daft Punk. And I was in Marseille that summer, and anywhere you went, you would hear it, walking by a store, on a boombox, on somebody's bicycle. And it was just this constant, continuous scroll where one part of the song left off, a new part took up, depending on whether you were exiting or entering a space. And so Sadie describes that. And in a way, it was just, oh, she goes to Marseille with Lucien, her fake boyfriend. And is observing this world, and it needs to take place in a time. And this song, Get Lucky, was in my head. It's almost like it was like an image that I could tease something from, a theme, even, because she seems to believe that she's always the lucky one. And so then I thought, well, that's it. It's 2013. But it also happens to have been a time when there were milieu of leftists who were, kind of standing up firm against the French state. But then again, Joe, this is also happening now. My whole theme in the book about what the French call mega basins, these
Right.
large reserves where the French state wants to pull a lot of the water out of the water table and put it into these huge plastic-lined bays, kind of to create a monopoly on water in parts of France so that the larger agricultural industrial concerns can take it and take it away from small farmers. I'd seen some reference to the mega basins, and then I just went with that and made it like, that's the big issue for the people in the book. They're fighting against the state on this, and these anarchists from Paris who really know nothing about farming are partnering with the French farmers. While they do end up finding out that they have some of their ideas about how life should be lived are pretty different than these farmers who are actually socially quite conservative. I just ran with that in the book, and then after I finished it and have been was doing the edits and getting ready for the book to come out, there's been a ton of news in France about pitched battles between anarchist farmers and the French state over precisely this issue of water and these mega basins. And I sent the guy in my book who's like a sub minister in France. His name is Platon. He's a little kind of like a send up for this French politician who's actually Spanish, named Manuel Valls, who was prime minister, much higher up in the government than my minister. But I send him to an agricultural fair where he is attacked and driven out, and worse, for those who haven't read the book yet. And then Emmanuel Macron went to the agricultural fair in Paris just a few months ago, and they blocked him from entering. So I said it in 2013, but some of what happens in the book seems to have anticipated things that are happening right now.
Rachel Kushner's new novel is Creation Lake. It is published by Scribner. Thanks to our producer, Sarah LaDuke. Write to us at book@wamc.org. The latest on National Productions programs is available via the Airwaves newsletter at wamc.org and on social media at WAMC Radio. Bookmark us for next week, and thanks for listening for The Book Show. I'm Joe Donahue.